Right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the LSE, and a special welcome to the director of the Institut Français, François Coquette, to this night of ideas. My name is Simon Glendinning, and I'm the professor of European philosophy in the European Institute here at the LSE, and I'm also director of the Forum for European Philosophy, which is an educational charity which puts on public events throughout the year at the LSE. I'm very proud to put on events that are free and open to all, and it's great to see the public's entering into the university. This evening's events are part of actually something much bigger than the LSE, the worldwide series of events coordinated by the Institut Français, and the LSE is really delighted to be playing its part, hosting tonight 9 events between 6 and 10 tonight. Our contribution, the LSE's contribution to the Night of Ideas, will bring together leading thinkers and researchers from France, from the UK, and from other countries in Europe to discuss changing ideas of citizenship and democracy. Ideas which I think it's clear are in conditions of considerable stress today, fragile, perhaps more fragile than ever before in my life, fragile and threatened. And not so much threatened by anything like an external power. I mean, there may well be external powers who would like to make our fragile and threatened democracy and citizenship even more so, but it's much less than that sort of standard form of a threat. It's much more of a condition, perhaps, of what the great French poet Paul Valéry called its own disarray. More than ever, I think we need nights like this, and I'm grateful to the Institut Français for putting it together. Now, in a moment, I'm going to have to go and prepare my own contribution, and shortly we'll leave you in the capable hands of Lucy Campos, who will be chairing this first event. But before then, we'll have a word from François Coquette, director of the Institut Français. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Simon. I just wanted to say a few words, well, to thank the LSE, really, for being mad enough to agree to a proposal of having this event here at the London School of Economics and Political Science. We felt it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense to have this debate today in this place. As you said, tonight's event is part of a worldwide series of debates all around the world. So we are having events in America, in Africa, in Asia. But this Night of Ideas started in London, really, so it's coming back home. The first concept that we started was My Night with Philosophers, and it was here in London. This is where it all started, and we felt we had to be here to discuss these ideals you've just mentioned, to discuss them as French, English, Europeans, citizens of nowhere, now more than ever. So thank you very much for being here, and I'll hand over the mic to Lucy, who's going to chair this event. Thank you very much.
So thank you, François and Simon, for those introductory words. My name is Lucy Campos. There's a slight mistake up there. I run the French Book Office here in the French Institute. I'm very, very honored to be chairing this discussion between two citizens of the world, Sylvain Bourmeau, to the far left here, and Jonathan Fenby. It's going to be a one-hour discussion. We have until 7 p.m. I'm going to start with a few words of introduction, then hand over quite quickly to Sylvain and Jonathan, and we will leave 15 minutes at the end for questions. So please wait until about 6:45 for your questions, and I will be happy to take them. Sylvain Bourmeau has been writing for Libération for decades, may I say, and has been a major figure of both French printed press and radio for a long time now. He was for a while deputy head of the magazine Les Inrecuptibles, took part in the creation of the online newspaper Mediapart, and was also one of the editors-in-chief of the French daily newspaper Libération until 2014. He's now taken a step back from that daily newsroom struggle to dedicate more time to poetry, teaching, radio. He's executive producer and host of the French radio show La Suite dans les Idées on France Culture, which focuses on social sciences and current affairs, current debates. And he is now, since 2014, associate professor at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, where he teaches journalism and social sciences, or explores. This year, he's just published a poetry collection entitled Batonnage, in which he recreates poems out of newspaper articles by borrowing fragments, offering a reflection on the constant presence of world news and social media in our lives. This is Batonnage, not yet translated into English, but we look forward to reading it soon. Jonathan Fenby is a British writer, journalist, analyst, specialist of China, amongst many other things. He has been writing about China for 20 years or more.
And about France for longer.
And about France for even longer. He's recently, last year, published A History of France. And is an expert not only of China, but also European affairs generally. You covered France and Germany for 12 years for The Economist, The London Times, for Reuters. He's written several books on France, broadcast regularly on European affairs for French, German, Swiss, Belgian and US media, and gives many talks and international conferences. So welcome to both. We are here for the opening dialogue of what's going to be a long series of discussions tonight, and we have the heart of the problem here in what has appeared in the last 6 months as we were working on the project of these series of conferences. The idea of post-truth appeared last July and has since risen further and further and further until it got to the surface of a lot of the things that we are reading and talking about today. Sylvain and Jonathan have accepted to take part in a dialogue this evening about that notion of post-truth. So I'm going to start with a very, very simple question. What is post-truth the name of, and what was truth before post-truth? Sylvain, would you like to start?
Yes, okay. Thank you very much for this large question. Post-truth, as you know, probably has been chosen as the word of the year by the Oxford English Dictionary. And I'd like to start by reading the definition. Post-truth is an adjective relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. I'd like to talk about these two elements. Opinions and beliefs, or opinions, emotions, sorry, and opinions. I think we have to analyze how these two dimensions are playing a very important part in what we call post-truth, and how they now shape the public debate in many ways. I think I will have the occasion to do that in our dialogue. But I'd like to start by what was the reference article about the concept, very important event for you in London and in Britain in general, of course, the Brexit vote and the analysis published a few days after the vote by the Guardian editor, Catherine Viner, and the title of her piece, which was widely read in France as well, by journalists at least, was How Technology Disrupted the Truth. And I think we have to ask, is it really technology? And is it really disruption? I don't think technology is a sufficient element to explain what happened, and I'm not sure it is as disruptive as presented. I think it's rather the result of a pretty long story that I'd like to start in the 1830s with invention of journalism as we know it now, with the commercial press in France, Émile Girardin, and with the penny papers in the US and the equivalent in Britain and in London in particular. So I think it's a very, very long story that we have to try to tell tonight to understand how we came in this situation where things have probably worsened, but certainly not appeared suddenly in 2016. I mean, it's rather the result of a very long process for me, post-truth.
So, a long story, 180 years of story. Jonathan, what truth was before post-truth, and what is post-truth the name of?
Well, aged as I am, I can't go back 118 years. Fine. But I think there has been a feeling, certainly for several decades now, that the kind of comfortable assumptions that were made about there being an objective, accurate truth as such, which could be attained and reached, that idea has come under increasing attack or increasing threat. I mean, I'd agree with Sylvain that I don't think the technology as such causes this. It's the use that's made of the technology and the impact of the technology. The technology, in the end, is a vehicle, a medium, if you like, and it's the question is what use is made of that. When I started working for Reuters News Agency in 1963, which gives you an idea of my age, there was this idea, certainly at Reuters, that there was an objective, impartial, accurate truth which we would be collecting, reporting, editing, and then, importantly, selling to the world, and that accuracy at that point had a commercial value. This applied in media news, but then, of course, in the 1970s, 1980s, became a very important element in the distribution of financial and economic news, which certainly saved Reuters, Bacon, Bloomberg, lots of other Dow Jones, lots of other information services, where accuracy was absolutely essential. Because if you were selling a service to an investment bank or a hedge fund or whoever it was, if it wasn't precise and right, they were going to lose a lot of money on it. If you were faster and more accurate than others, they would pay you accordingly. And that was in a kind of golden era, I would say, around the 80s, 90s of the last century, when this idea of truth, impartiality, and so on was A, commercially backed up, and it's always, one sees, one would like journalism to be a kind of charity, benevolent above the market, but it isn't, as we know. That was quite a, for me, that was quite a, actually a defence, the commercial nature of the media at the time, of this idea of truth. But what we've had since then, and here it is the technology which has had the effect, is obviously the increasing economic problems of conventional mainstream media, particularly in the press. And I think you have to put this whole evolution that we've seen recently in that context. And that evolution has been accompanied by an alarming decline in the degree of public trust in the conventional media, which the media itself has helped, actually, the decline in trust, given that it has become more and more partisan, not just in its opinion columns. I mean, the famous, facts are sacred, opinion is free, but facts are sacred, the old Guardian motto, and so on, has become less and less the case, that the reporting of these supposedly impartial facts has become more and more slanted according to the political opinion of the vehicle, the newspaper or whatever it is, that is carrying them. You then have the advent of social media, where really anything goes. Anybody can say anything. Everybody is empowered to react. And in this, emotion comes in, obviously, a great deal. And it's fast. It makes an impact. It's accurate. I mean, yeah, I use social media, as I'm sure everybody here does. And I often have to hold myself back from reacting to something that I think is particularly stupid, but that the person posting it probably thought was particularly intelligent. So you've got that direct kind of human confrontation taking place in an area which isn't really the kind of media that Sylvain and myself used to work in, but is adjunct to it and then influences back on the media. So we've got, I think, a great cauldron there. And to go back to where I started, I mean, this goes back quite a long time. There was this idea of truth. You couldn't necessarily define it. It was difficult to do so. You could bring out dictionary definitions, different to do so. But that began to be challenged actually back in the 1970s when I was editor of Reuters, and we came under a lot of attack from some third world governments, which weren't great necessarily proponents of freedom of press within their own countries, and UNESCO, because our idea of the truth was a Western, white, market-driven, liberal doctrine approach, which had to be replaced by something that was the real truth for developing what were then called third world countries. So the challenge, if you like, to the old certainties has been going on for a long time. But obviously, we've seen, and this is the reason we're here tonight, in the last year or so, an enormous kind of a parallel counter-truth culture, which has swamped very often the existing culture. Now, I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that actually, you know, if you say something in press or on the radio or television, you should have evidence for it. And if you don't have evidence, or if the evidence goes the wrong way, you're wrong. But that is no longer the accepted fact. And when you have the President of the United States demonstrably lying and very proud of it, and he's not going to pull back from that. Why should I? You know, I know the facts. We have this feeling now that anybody can know the facts. And I think the kind of conventional media, in which certainly I grew up, is very much on the back foot and just doesn't know the heck what to do about this.
So we've talked about a longer history of the technology of the media, the economic reality behind the media, and a longer history of trust in which this notion of post-truth needs to be resituated. It feels as if we're talking about truth as if truth was something terribly civilized and sage, as we would say in French, something very good and reliable. Truth isn't necessarily that. And in that original article by Catherine Viner that you were quoting, Sylvain, there was a lot about scandal and humiliation and brazen allegations. Aren't we forgetting an element of that when we talk about journalism?
Well, of course, it's at the heart of professional journalism as it started back in the 19th century. I think one of the mistakes of Catherine Viner in her piece, which was very interesting, is the fact that she points the responsibility of the social networks very much, and probably too much. And I think she misses a very important point, which has to do with how the business models of the media have changed. And particularly, it could have been a very interesting question for the editor of The Guardian, which is the only at the time, and quality paper in the world that relied on the model of free content, whereas the New York Times has moved to a different business model in a very wise move, I would say. But to understand really what happened with the business model, because I think it's very important. It's one of the reasons why post-truth has become so important and visible now. I think what happened, to cut a long story short, I mean, what happened is if we take the newspapers back in the 1830s till, I mean, the web now, going through radio and television in the middle, is the fact that emotions have come to play more and more important role. Emotions were right at the start of this professional journalism in the 19th century. It has been documented by many historians, Dominique Khalifa in France. I mean, the relationship between crime and newspapers, for example, is very very important. But that was print. So newspapers managed to earn money in two ways. I mean, that's something very important, I think. Newspapers are very strange product. They are products that are on sale on two different markets. I recently learned that economists use a concept to describe it as I don't know if they use it in English. It's a marché à deux versants. It's a two-way market.
Two-sided market?
Two-sided market, maybe. It's the one market is the readers and the other one is the advertisers, and they always have been connected. And I think what happened is we need to write the history of how this articulation between the market of the readers and the market of the advertisers has evolved over time.
And I mean, the brilliant thing, sorry, just making it, in the 19th century, was that the newspapers evolved the business model of charging their readers for buying the product and then selling the readers to the advertisers. So you were doubling up on the money there.
There were
and that has broken down because the number of readers has fallen hugely and the advertisers can find it cheaper online.
In a way, I mean, I think we could say the media are attention brokers. They sell attention. Temps de cerveau disponible, used to say the head of a TV channel in France, to advertisers.
Available brain time. Yeah.
And they sell a service to readers, which is more and more important now that we have a lot of information, which is selection of information in order that readers can devote their attention to the very important things. So there are attention brokers in many ways. But the way exactly it worked between readers and advertisers has changed over time. And what happened is, to put it really in a very short way, is that the history of the media can be told as an history of the reduction of the time needed by a producer of editorial content to get information, to get feedback, commercial feedback of what he offers on the market. A newspaper, it takes a few days to exactly know the sales. Radio, there are audiences surveys, but at France Culture, for example, we got the figures every 2 months, and they are not related to a particular program. I mean, they are related to an hour, but you wouldn't know if choosing a theme of a program one particular day would have been successful or not. And then TV changed it really, because on the morning after, you know the figures. And you can see if you were right to talk about the environment or about the economy. So it has an impact on the editorial policy, a very direct impact. And what we have now is the web. And this time now is null. I mean, the web works in when you're a web editor now in a newspaper, you got the feedback as soon as you publish something. You got the figures through a software called Chartbeat, for example, where you know exactly how many people are reading the piece at one moment, how many people have read the piece since you published it. And then, so your editorial offer, the hierarchy of the information, is now largely influenced and sometimes made by the readers. Mm-hmm. And what the readers do actually is that they react through emotions. They are laughing, they are unnerved, they are excited, and so it means that emotions are sort of monitoring. I mean, they are monitoring the news stories on a website now. And I think the business model of free, especially, has made it possible for emotion to be the pilot of the media in a way that never happened before. And that's new. It's the product of a very long story, but that's new.
So, and this story has taken... So we've moved through emotions and their structural role in defining the relationship between the press and its readership, I mean, media and their readership, through attention brokers, and then the idea of real time getting shorter and shorter. This is all... Is this measurable? What are the indicators that are other indicators of post-truth? Are the indicators a short? Is this time? Is it measured in time? Is time getting? You've said time is getting shorter, and the response time, reaction time, is getting shorter. Is it? Are the new indicators the number of clicks and online presence? What are the new indicators that give weight to this or that media content?
It's very largely the clicks, and it's the instances, as I was saying. But in this, of course, the important thing is, I mean, this is a dread word now, but the role of what used to be called the gatekeeper in this, which was editors and people and journalists and so on, who were meant to be maintaining a certain level of truth. Truth in the sense that if information was put out, it could be backed up with facts and proven things. Now, of course, you know, that this was never as shining a light as it appeared. I mean, for instance, I mean, we all know that a lot of information in kind of classic newspaper style came from sources, so you would quote a source and therefore it was accurate, but that source might have any kind of agenda there. I mean, in, you know, in Britain, the use, for instance, of the parliamentary lobby by governments for a long time to do down their opponents and so on. Yes, you know, the information was coming from a government source, although you weren't allowed to name it at that early on and so on, but it wasn't necessarily true for that. And even if you take, you know, Watergate, for instance, I mean, Deep Throat was leaking to Woodward and Bernstein for a reason. Sources always have a reason. They're not going to just come up to you on the street and say, you know, I heard something nice and so on. I mean, that happened to me once when somebody gave me the manuscript of the Spy Catcher, the banned book here in a pub, literally said to me, do you want this? And gave it to me. We had the biggest scoop at the Independent that we'd ever had. But that was a fellow journalist who happened to came into his possession. So it does happen. But, you know, the truth is, and one of the jobs in the past of the gatekeepers was to try to... distinguish what was actually going to be provable truth in the end and what was a nice story, but I don't think we can run with this because actually it's not true. Now, when you get into the world of the web and the internet now, and I don't speak of this as somebody who my day job depends on the internet and so on, so I'm not in any way criticizing that about it. That breaks down completely because you can put anything up you like, more or less, and the emotion then comes in. And I mean, to just go back, I won't go on too long, I can claim to have been one of the early victims of post-truth. When I was editing the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong, an English teacher whose column we hadn't taken on at the paper set up a website called Not the South China Morning Post, which quickly evolved into personal attacks on me as editor. And according to this website, I had to flee Britain, having completely failed professionally in every way. I was probably a paedophile who was running away from the police. I was drunk on gin and tonic at lunch every day and had to be taken home in a car. My wife had left me, and I was receiving large monthly payments from Beijing for running propaganda. Now, the fact that I don't drink gin and tonic, I don't drink at lunchtime, my wife hadn't left me, I don't think I'm a paedophile, and I had weekly rows with the owner of the paper because he thought we weren't friendly enough to Beijing. Beijing. None of that counted for anything in this. This guy just went on and on. And when I made the terrible mistake one night, probably after too many glasses of wine, not gin and tonic, of replying to him, you know, Fenby's running scared. It must all be true. Because thing, and there is nothing you can do about this. And that was in 1997. And you can see the way that the in the post-truth world, as we called it, in a sense, everything feeds on itself in a very easy way, and there is no restraint on it. And in a sense, you know, perhaps this is not either surprising or particularly deplorable. What is deplorable is when that then comes into areas of life and governance and so on, which actually affect the well-being and futures of an awful lot of people, as is happening in the US.
Okay, so we've talked about emotions. How about beliefs and content? Now, coming back to the Catherine Viner article, sorry to come back to it, but it's the sort of the first long definition of what we're now talking about as post-truth. It was very much centered on the idea that facts don't work. Facts no longer work. So that fact, as journalists, journalists with a long experience, can you say something about the rituals that produce what we call objectivity of fact?
Well, it has to do with what Jonathan said about the debates that had been running in the 60s at Reuters and then in the 70s. I think, of course, these debates are not only in journalism. There have been a lot of debates in the social sciences about and in philosophy about truth and relativism has been very strong starting in the 60s probably, but there is a specificity with journalism. It has to do with the fact that journalism is a very poorly reflexive activity. I always say that if medical doctors or architects were as poorly reflexive as journalists, we would have very great problems with our bodies and our buildings. But journalists have always a good reason not to think, which is the urgency, the fact that they have to produce a new article or new newspaper every day, and so they don't like to think too much about what they are doing. So in other ways, the journalistic epistemology is something that does not really exist, which is a very big problem if your job is about finding the truth. To play the role of what should be an epistemology, journalists have produced procedures, and one of them is think about how you can objectify things, how you can produce objectivity in a very ritualistic way. Sociologists have written about that in the 70s. There is a very interesting book by Gay Tuckman about the subject in a Goffmanian perspective. But it's always true. I mean, and it has become more and more true as the new media have appeared, 24-hour news channels, on which you don't have much reporting. You have a lot of panels, a lot of discussion, and the way to produce objectivity in this media is to cast a panel that will produce a spectacle. And people that strongly disagree, for example, and you imagine that that's probably the best way to produce objectivity. You know, the film director Jean-Luc Godard has been laughing about that for many, many years now, of saying it's the 1 minute for Hitler, 1 minute for the Jews system. But journalism works very much on that principle, and especially the 24-hour news channels. And it's a big, big, big problem that we have in all newsrooms now. I think journalists should really think about how they objectify reality. Okay. They have a hard work to do. And I think the solution, just one word on that, the solution is not the new fashion in French journalism. I mean, they discovered that we can do fact-checking in Anglo-Saxon, I mean, in America or in Britain. It's something that has been going on for many, many years. But in France, we started about 3 or 4 years ago. And
your problem is you have the conditional tense.
Yeah.
very useful.
Yeah. And so we have Desintox in Libération, Les Décodeurs in Le Monde. And it's very interesting. It's very important, fact-checking. But, I mean, do you think the scientific community spend time to fact-check liars like Donald Trump? Mm. I mean, if somebody is as credible as Trump, you know, in any scientific field, would submit a proposition for a journal, I mean, the journal wouldn't even take 2 minutes to look at it. So the problem is that the democratic condition forces you to look at the proposition by Donald Trump as if it was serious. And that's a big problem. And I think journalists should compare their position with the academic position. And whereas they do fact-checking, they should deconstruct the way problems are submitted, the way panels are constructed, rather than verify if the quantity of something is right or wrong, which is not a real problem, actually.
Well, I think we've seen that. I mean, that's why we're here now. Last year, exactly what I said, because you have, it's a mixture of the commercial pressure of, you know, news, if we can use that word still, as entertainment, and the idea of balance that there is. I mean, during the Brexit campaign, you could see that's where the BBC was completely, was rendered, you know, almost unable to act, the BBC, because it had to give an equal amount of time to a lie from Nigel Farage, and maybe he would say a lie from the other side. So, you know, you were doing that the whole time. And certainly, you know, that, I think, was a development here through the Brexit campaign, which has certainly pushed the idea of an objective truth much further away. You then had in the US, I mean, I just use the example of the head of CNN, which, of course, is now Trump's bête noire. But he was quoted as saying, Trump was great for us because he sent up the ratings all the time. And I must say, I admit, I was in the US twice this autumn, and just before the week before the election, and I go into my hotel room after meetings all day, turn on the television, and if Trump was there, I would sit and watch him because, you know, it's entertainment, in a sense. You know, how far can this guy go? Is he real, or is he actually a hologram that, that people have put together?
Emotions.
I mean, it's for emotions, that, and you were caught with that. And
spectacle.
So on. It's spectacular. And so that, you know, because nobody asks, if you go to a spectacle, but nobody, you don't ask for it to be true. You don't expect Shakespeare to be true, in a sense.
It's a TV show.
But it's a show. And the trouble is that that has taken over certainly an awful lot of politics and perhaps other parts of life.
And we've had a magnificent sort of the ingredients for a charter for new journalism from both of you. Can we?
Sorry, the other thing to say, I'm sorry, we go, this shows you journalists, we always talk about business, and so I'll go back to business. But as somebody said, New York Times editor, Dean Baquet, I think, the problem with the difficulty with truth and truthful reporting is that it takes a long time and it's very expensive, which is true.
It is true, and we're back to the economic models. Can I, as a sort of last element for this conversation, play the role of... So Faisal Islam was supposed to chair this panel, and Faisal, as you know, has been quite vocal about recent events in the UK. He is unable to chair tonight because he's on the plane with Theresa May. He's just arrived in New York, and he is going to attend the meeting between Theresa May and Donald Trump, which is the best excuse ever for not chairing a panel. But can I bring us back to national context? Because we have two wonderful incarnations of French journalism, sorry Sylvain, and British journalism, sorry Jonathan. Can we talk just a little bit about... So, Sylvain, I know that you started giving seminars about journalism and social sciences after what was a very big moment in French politics, which was the 21 avril 2001, when Marine Le Pen nearly got... Jean-Marie Le Pen nearly reached the French presidency. So that started off something new that was trying to reflect on what journalism is and what role it should play in the French public sphere. And then I'm going to ask the same question of Jonathan just afterwards about the referendum and its consequences.
Well, yes, it was a shock, this first round of the presidential election. And it came after a campaign that was dominated by the issue of crime and security. In an absurd way, in a very irrational and way, in which emotions have played a very important part, especially just a few hours before the vote, the story of an old man that had been beaten in his house had played probably a very important role in the vote. So we decided with a friend of mine, Nicolas Demorand, when later was the editor of Libération and is a radio producer at France Inter now, that we should do something as citizens about how journalism was made. And we decided that probably the best thing to do was trying to have an input on the formation of the education of future journalism. And we sort of decided to the best place to do that was not journalism schools, but the last year of school at Sciences Po in Paris, the fifth year in which many people became later journalists and try to explain to future journalists that they should not forget in journalism schools what they had learned in their education in universities or at Sciences Po in the social sciences, that they should bring with them in their professional practice as journalists all the methods, the epistemology questions that they have learned to think about, whether they studied history or philosophy or economics or law, or because they come from very diverse situations. And it was... I think we still have to do that. It's very difficult because we have... The situation is very different in France. We have journalism schools that are very different from the British ones. The British ones are very practical and they are not intellectual formation. The French journalism schools are not intellectual formations. They are anti-intellectual education. They want students to forget everything they learned before in the university so that they can produce journalism in a quicker way.
So if there are any French policymakers in the room, please listen.
So I think we have to develop a new kind of journalism school, maybe on a European level.
Can you tell us what are... one or two or three main epistemological references that you bring to that seminar? I know that you invite philosophers, I know that you invite economists, that you invite sociologists. What are the sort of the main guidelines?
Well, I mean, you know, there are many references for example, one of the good things afterwards in Sciences Po was the arrival of Bruno Latour, and that was a way for people to think about how facts are sometimes constructed. But also, I think it is very important for journalists or future journalists to talk about business, because maybe editors are used to it, but journalists tend to see it as something dangerous, and they don't want to hear too much about business questions, because they think if they are too much into business discussion, it would be very difficult to do journalism in an independent way, which is a big mistake. I think if you are a journalist, you always have to think about the material conditions under which you can produce the kind of journalism you'd like to produce.
Thank you. Jonathan? the conceptual framework within we should be thinking of what's happening to journalism right now after, well, what we can now call Brexit as of today.
Well, of course, as a dyed-in-the-wool English traditional journalist, I'd say we don't do conceptual frameworks and so on. We just get on with the job. And that certainly has always been the approach in Britain. I mean, you know, the idea of journalism schools is still a slightly foreign thing for Britain long term. And you certainly don't talk about any of these fancy French philosophical notions. You get on with learning your Pitmans, or you used to. But the problem is that I think, and this is largely so in the United States too, took place in a context, an environment, in which the media, as vehicles for what was supposed to be accurate information, lived a kind of privileged life where, you know, we didn't have many legal constraints on us because, in a sense, we didn't need the law. We were outside the law. Society, one felt, would reward good journalism and good truth telling. I mean, I don't want to be pompous or think that, but when I was at the Independent, I ran the British news section and the Independent. We felt in a rather boyish way we were doing a good thing, you know. And when the circulation didn't go up, we were slightly perturbed, and then it did go up in the end for a while, and so on and so on. But there was this idea of there was some kind of accuracy, some kind of truth, some kind of impartiality, which you knew in reality you couldn't always reach, but which was there as the conceptual, if you like, success and so on. And I don't think that exists anymore. And for what exact reasons, I'm sure people in the audience in the room can tell us, but that's the trouble, that it's become very difficult to stand up and say, as we can see, I think, with the Brexit campaign, and even more so, obviously, with Trump, but that's simply not true, and to expect people to take notice of it. You come over as a rather, you know, boring old curmudgeon and so on. Get with it, you know, and you have Kellyanne Conway, you know, we're going to invent alternative facts. This is much more interesting. This is much sexier. What are you talking about? Because there was this idea of the front page, the news pages, should not be taking a point of view, and that it wasn't, although of course, you know, enemies of the people and so on has completely destroyed that, the Daily Mail. It was very interesting the other day, the Washington Post, front page headline on Trump talking about, you know, the made up numbers, insisting he had the biggest inauguration ever, began, "Without evidence, the president says this." 5 years ago, you wouldn't have said that at all. No, you wouldn't have said that. There is a bit of a fight back in this sense, I think.
So, the end of impartial objectivity.
Yeah, although, you know, when you go to the other extent, like the Saturday Night Live, you know, you're going for Trump's 10-year-old boy and so on. You're down in the gutter there too, which is to be avoided also.
Questions. I will take maybe two questions to start with.
Thank you. Thank you for the talk. I think post-truth is a ridiculous and vacuous term that people have always been lied to. What we're seeing here is the middle class being surprised that all the billionaires who own our newspapers would actually lie to them and actually end up controlling the social media that their people think would give some sort of truth. What we should be really talking about is how capitalism has never given a merit about truth. Or give them a proper platform for truth. So this is what should be examined here, not this ridiculous term of post-truth.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mine is a very similar point. Does it matter? What do we have to fear when it's born out of? Thank you. When it's born out of popular opinion, I've loved what you said, but you look and sound a bit like the old order, wringing their hands at the loss of power. And I just wonder, you know, these are the emotions of ordinary people. They're genuine, you know, and you know, they are electing politicians and having their say on social media. This is a plebiscite that we're hearing from.
Yeah. I'm not sure that that's so. Well, of course, I'm speaking as an old fart. Yes, I know. Yeah, absolutely. But that's, I can't do anything else, can I? You know, I'm condemned. But I think the worry is that, yes, if a thousand flowers bloom, etc., etc., that's fine. But what this has resulted in, you know, and it's being used by, let's say, the Trump camp or the Farage camp in a way, that's what I was saying, which actually affects the way countries are run and the well-being and future of those people there. And that is quite a dangerous thing. I mean, if you get government by tweet, I'm not sure that that is the best way of actually running the society.
But they do.
Sylvain, money and the old order in France?
No, there are two different things I'd like to answer about the ordinary people. I mean, what is important to understand, I think, is not the kind of people that are subject to emotions. We all are subjects to emotion. What is important is to be able to have media that whose logic is not to capture the first emotion an ordinary people has in front of a content, because the first emotion you have can be not very interesting, even though you're very educated. You can be laughing at something you should not laugh at, and so we need time. We need and what we do now is to take into account the first emotion, and I think there is a very perverse way of valorizing the way people love to hate watching television, for example, rather than trying to measure how they would really love to watch some other kind of program. So that's one aspect of the problem. I think regarding money and capitalism, I think there is no fatality. I mean, the only way to I'm not against new technologies, and I started a media which is MediaPart online.
MediaPart, which
in order to show that it was possible to bring online some principles that we cherished as journalists and that we thought were really important to keep. So the problem is not the medium. The problem is these principles. The problem is that, for example, a newspaper, the concept of a newspaper as an editorial product should be protected. No matter it's on paper. I mean, paper does not matter at all. What is important is a newspaper that means the organization of information regarding their relevance or their importance, the role of gatekeepers. I think we need... I mean, that's how the academic world functions.
Sylvain, the numbers I have in mind for MediaPart are about 700,000 something. How many monthly readers?
Subscribers.
Subscribers.
There are 125, I think, thousands.
But then you have, yeah.
No, I just accept the first. Yes, I mean, the media we're talking about exists in, if you like, a market capitalist context and so on. And that brings a lot of strains, you know. You can see from the Murdoch Press, you can see from the Daily Mail, so on. But what it also does have, I would argue, and I'm sure you may disagree entirely, it does actually allow a certain freedom within that context. And I don't see that actually social media has done anything to reduce, if you like, the capitalist control of media. In some ways, it's increased it.
I agree with that.
Will I take
two
more questions?
To me.
Yes.
A couple of points. Is post-truth the new word for propaganda? One thinks of Goebbels and people like that who didn't deal in the truth as we would understand it. The other point I want to make is I take all the points you're making about your particular profession, but the people who voted for Trump and Brexit probably weren't too concerned about post-truth. They're probably concerned about losing their jobs and immigration. Yeah. You haven't touched on those. You almost abstracted the debate from the truths of these people's lives. I'm not defending them, particularly for voting that way, but I think if you could address that problem.
But if I could just say briefly, I mean, I spent a lot of time on the first point writing about China, and I probably offend some people here, but, you know, China has had a post-truth society for a very long time, indeed, where the truth is what the Communist Party says it is, regardless. You know, Tiananmen Square didn't really take place, or if it did, it was a rising by foreign black hands against the PLA, and so on and so on. You know, anybody who steps out of line is in trouble, so people get on with their lives, and so on. And that, I think, is an example of a kind of a long-standing state-sponsored post-truth area. What you said, secondly, I mean, sorry, that was meant to be implicit in a lot of things I said about the appeal, what I said about the appeal of truth and the Brexit people. I think the trouble is that, yes, there was obviously concern about immigration or about, you know, no jobs in the Rust Belt in the United States. The trouble was that the way these dialogues took place, largely through, well, not through conventional media too in this country, but largely through social media in the United States, actually distorted what the real issues there are, you know. And Trump's whole appeal is based on this kind of mythical idea that somehow manufacturing will be brought back to the Midwest and everybody will be very happy making T-shirts, you know, on Chinese assembly lines. Well, it just isn't going to happen, and I don't think they would want it to happen, people. And what you've got is the most right-wing program being put into effect, which will hit exactly the people who, if I was being very patronising, we're lulled by social, you know, by the appeal of the social media into voting with emotion for the Donald.
Thank you, Jonathan. Sylvain, do you want to talk a bit about economic reality, or should I take another?
About propaganda, because about I think propaganda. It's a very important point. I think you're right. I mean, we can use the word propaganda, and in many ways, the situation that we are in now reminds me what happened in the 1930s on that respect, and I'm. There is a very interesting book by a former journalist who is now an historian, a cultural historian and professor of communication at Stanford University, Fred Turner, about the birth of multimedia as a reaction by the Committee for National Morale by American intellectuals that were stunned by the power of propaganda in the Nazi regime in Germany and how they responded as intellectuals by creating a different use of the technology, of the media, which was to be, as Turner calls it, a democratic surround, which was multimedia. The propaganda had only one source. They decided to build a new media that would be more relevant to the American pluralist tradition, which was multimedia with several sources. And that led to a great exhibition at the MoMA by Edward Steichen and works by many artists and philosophers and anthropologists, Margaret Mead, of course, and Gregory Bateson. I think we're very much in that situation. I think intellectuals and journalists and people in charge of public speeches and discourse are very much required to invent new ways of communication, and we could use the social networks in order to do that, I think.
Thank you. So is there one last question before we finish? Yes.
I spend half time in Paris, and I just feel that you are a little unfair to the French media. You have a program called France 24, as you know, and they actually give lots of time for discussions every evening where they actually let people in for a panel where they don't interrupt them all the time as they do as Newsnight here, for example, another program. And here in England, I think there is much more or less time for a debate, and also the journalists are more partisan in a way. They show
themselves when there is something that is unacceptable. They are not neutral to fascism, I would say. As you get the feeling that journalists, in a way, won't think that they can be neutral. And that's why we have got the news we have got the last couple of years.
Thank you. So a question on time for truth.
Well, I would really exchange France 24 for Newsnight. I mean, I would love to have something like Newsnight on the French television.
Right. Well, so the, if
I, you know, and just listen to the journals. I mean, on the news bulletin on Radio 4 and compare.
To finish on,
standards are not the same.
Thank you. To finish on that note, maybe we should have a French journalist from time to time on British media and the other way around. Maybe this is what we should be doing. Thank you very much, Sylvain Bourmeau and Jonathan Fenby, both for taking part in this dialogue. Thank you, and thank you all.